Okay, this is it, folks. This is where we boil down the entire semester, the entire concept of investing into one lecture. And, of course, there's plenty of stuff that we have to learn about the individual alternatives, all the different types of investments. But first, we have to understand the eternal struggle between risk and return. Risk and reward. So stick with us here, folks. We're on slide 35, and we take a look at investment return, reward. Remember, return and reward basically mean the same thing. You'll hear people say return. Sometimes you'll hear people use the term performance, which I'm not too keen about, but it means the same thing. In other words, what did you get from your return? And make sure that you go back over the previous presentation and have that thumbnail view of the major alternatives, remembering all you have to know is what's in that previous presentation. We'll go into detail throughout the semester. But let's start here on slide 35 with a revisiting investment return. Over the long term, equities, stocks, have produced the best returns. Now, we're conveniently leaving out real estate, folks, because that's a whole different world. So we're talking about the world of securities here. The real estate investors jump up and down and say, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Well, yes, I do. But we're just conveniently ignoring real estate for now. Okay, so equities, stocks, ownership have returned the best returns over the long term. Over the long term, folks. And even though it's actually more than 8 to 10%, I usually use 8, 9, 10% to temper people's expectations. That's me. But some have done a whole lot better. Fixed income securities, such as bonds, fixed, have returned about 4 to 8%. Now, right now they're returning a whole lot less, and in other times of our modern financial history, they've returned less. But when things are fairly normal, they return about 4 or 5% for treasuries and municipal bonds, sometimes 6, 5, 6, 7, sometimes 8 for corporate bonds, kind of like a mortgage, right? But mortgages now are really low. And then the short-term cash investments have returned 2, 3, 4, sometimes 5, now 0.2. Mutual funds will more or less, sometimes less, often less, will reflect the underlying assets that they invest in. So here is a graphic from the 7th edition of the book that shows you how well stocks have done versus treasury bills, which is a form of short-term investment, versus bonds and inflation. And we go back to 1926, and we find that stocks have just clobbered bonds and treasury bills. Treasury bills have beaten inflation, but not a whole lot. And we want you to ignore small company stocks. When you're going through chapter one, just look at them, but just realize that small company stocks do better over large company stocks over the long term, but they're incredibly volatile, and there's a situation called survivorship bias. The small companies that don't survive don't get counted, right? Because they're dead. So even the people who make these statistics will tell you, yeah, small company stocks do better, but it's not worth it. It's not worth it to even consider them in our conversation. Just ignore them for our conversation. I should just, use the graphic program to just wipe the whole thing out. So you see, stocks have done much better than treasury bonds and treasury bills and inflation. And here is a much longer term view on slide 37, showing that stocks have just exponentially. And you see, this is a logarithmic scale. I don't know if you understand logarithms. If you don't try because they're sneaky. But the idea is it turns an exponential curve into a straight curve. Right, there's the oxymoron again, straight curve. You see, instead of going up by 1, they're going up by a factor of 10 every increment. And this is why a Category 8 earthquake is not twice as large as a Category 4 earthquake. It's 10 to the 4th times, 10,000 times more powerful. People don't understand logarithms. But anyway, you see from this graph that stocks have just clobbered bonds and treasury bills and gold, which has barely kept up with inflation. And when people tell me, they start jumping up and down about gold, you know, sometimes you'll get a student in a class who says, when are we going to talk about gold? When are we going to talk about gold? I show them this form. I show them this graph, and they go, oh. When does gold do well? Gold does well when people believe that the world is going to end. If the world does end, it doesn't really matter what you have. But we'll get to gold and precious metals at the very end of the semester, folks. So don't worry. You'll learn about why gold is not a very good investment, unless you believe the world is going to end. But in that case, you really need to leave the Northern Hemisphere, make your way to Tierra del Fuego or Tasmania, learn to raise goats and grow your own food, and yeah, exactly. So you see, folks, who's the best, right? Stocks. And that's the one we're going to spend our most of our time on. Okay, makes sense. They get all the press. Which segment is more important? Well, it turns out bonds are, but that's a different story. Slide 38. It is no accident that stocks and bonds have produced better returns than short-term investments. And it's no accident that stocks have done better than bonds. Why? Otherwise, why would investors assume the higher risk of stocks and the risk of bonds that we'll discuss later on in the chat in the semester? Why wouldn't they just assume what is called the risk-free rate of return? The return on guaranteed short-term investments such as treasury bills or savings accounts or money market accounts that we'll go into detail in our final presentation of Chapter 1, the next presentation. Right, if you could get the same return from something that was risk-free, you wouldn't bother investing in something that was very risky like stocks, and there is some risk in bonds too. And so that's why we often call the return on 3-month U.S. Treasury bills the risk-free rate of return. And so you'll hear people say, well, what's the risk-free rate of return these days? Like, go look up the 3-month Treasury bill. Okay, I got to beat that. I hope to beat that. And the risk premium is the reward for bearing that risk, the extra return on a risky asset above and beyond, over the risk-free rate of return. So here is a table from your book that shows the risk premiums for the major categories. Again, let's ignore small company stocks. But it turns out that, you know, over the last 75, 80 years, large company stocks have returned 11.7% as measured by the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, which we'll discuss in detail when we get to Chapter 5. But we'll also discuss it in Chapter 4 on mutual funds because it's such an important index, such an important measure. And it turns out that they have done 8% more than Treasury bills, which have returned 3.7%. And notice the risk premium is zero because they are what you're measuring the premium against. Small company stocks look a whole lot better, but again, we're ignoring them because of that survivorship bias. Bonds from corporations and government bonds have done, 2.5-3% better than Treasury bills. And what we have to remember is that inflation is always in the background, folks. So treasury bills have beaten inflation, but not by much, inflation running about 3%, whereas bonds have beaten it by 2.5%, 3%, and stocks have beaten it by, you know, over 8%, 8, 9%. Right. Stocks are there for the long term. So, risk versus reward, risk versus return, slide number 40. How do we measure risk? It turns out it's not easy. In fact, it's darn right impossible. Investment return is very straightforward. How much did you start with? How much did you end with? How long did it take you? That's your return. But measuring how much risk you took to receive that return is much more difficult. In fact, it's, as I just said, it's impossible. You can't do it. You can't measure risk perfectly. So what we use are the best tools we have, and those are variance and standard deviation. Each year, the investment community measures the average annual return and the amount of variance from the average return, which is a fancy way of saying the difference. You know, how much did it fall away from that average? Using statistics, the resulting measures of risk are called variance and standard deviation. Slide number 40. Yeah, I know. My undergraduate degree is mathematics, and I spent in my undergraduate years 3 semesters in statistics because I loved it, and then actually did some work out in the industry in various locations using statistics. But I know many of you just would rather eat barbed wire than do these calculations. And the good news is, folks, you don't have to do them. You just look them up on the infernal net, and they're there for you. We will leave the calculations for your statistics class, okay? Suffice to say, and you're going to memorize this because you better not get it wrong on the exam because it makes me feel bad. It's bad for my self-esteem. Don't get this wrong. The higher the variance and standard deviation, the riskier the investment. The more the investment return will deviate from the average annual return. And what are these formulas? Don't worry about them, but really all they're doing, it looks scary because it's got these Greek symbols and all this stuff. They're taking the return of any one year and they're subtracting it from the average return. Okay, so how far away is the return for any given year? That's R sub I, minus R bar, which is the average, the mean average. And then we square it. And why do we square it? Well, because that takes away the negative sign. Sometimes it's above, sometimes it's below, but if we square them, they're always positive. And then this symbol that you've seen in your spreadsheet stands for summation. Sum those numbers from the first year up to however many years you do the calculations for, 50 years, 25 years, whatever. And you take that sum and divide it by the number of years minus 1. Why do they take statistics? And you get a number called the variance. And that's important, but the square root of that is actually more important, and that's called the standard deviation. And that's the one you'll see reported. You won't see the variance reported. You'll see the standard deviation reported websites and the publications that we research throughout the semester. And look, these are just fancy schmancy terms for you can lose your money, folks. That's all they're telling. They're trying to tell you is, hey, you know what? You expect to get 10%, but in reality, you might get that 10% over time, but in 1 year, you're going to get 22, next year, minus 17, 4, 12, minus 5. It's going to bounce around a lot. So if now we graph these returns in what's called a frequency distribution graph on slide 42, we see in more detail, or at least something that we can understand, what we're talking about here. What's going on here? Well, sure, the average is around 10%. Actually, it's a little bit more, not much more. But in any one given year, you don't know what you're going to get. As we said, it bounces around a lot. And so we see that in some years, it's done really poorly. 1931, 1937, 2008. You got to go back to the Great Depression to see years as bad. 74, 2002, 2001, these were not great years. And some years is done pretty darn well. 1958, that's when the stock market was screaming and hollering in two directions, up and way up. Same thing is true with 97 and 95. And look, in the depths of the Great Depression, two of the best years, while they were bouncing off of lows, 1933 and 1935. But in general, most of the years are concentrated around the mean, around the average of around 10%. And you might have heard that 2016, it only went up 9.5%. Actually, that's true, but that only takes into account the capital gains, doesn't take into account the dividends, and we love dividends. And so with the dividends, it went over 10%. Not much, like 11.5%. Or so. But still, what we find is that in any one given year, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to be close to what you expect, but there's also a pretty good chance that you're not going to be close to what you expect. And this distribution should resemble something that you are very familiar with. Yes, yes. Yes, of course, yes. It's the bell curve, the normal curve, the normal distribution. And for some reason in nature has been kind to us statisticians. Many, many, many things that we observe in nature follow the bell curve, the normal distribution. And so, when we look at stocks, we find that stocks have had a average annual return since modern finance. And why do we choose the 1920s? And there's some historical reasons for that, which we won't go into. But since the modern world, the stock market has returned 11.7%. Remember, I tell people 8, 9, 10%, but it's actually done better. But it's never 11.7% in one year, folks. It bounces back and forth. And what does standard deviation tell us? That in the past, when we measure this amount of deviation from the normal amount, from the average annual return, we find that in any one year, there's about a two-thirds chance that the return will fall within one standard deviation, plus or minus one standard deviation. That's what all these funny-looking symbols are just trying to tell you folks. You go away one standard deviation on either side, and you got about a two-thirds chance that you're going to fall in between that number. If you go out two standard deviations, that amount goes up to 95%. You have a 95% chance of being within two standard deviations. And then if you go out three standard deviations, you have a better than 99% chance of that number falling somewhere in between the three standard deviations. So you see what's going on? Investment returns over time tend to mirror the bell curve. So you have to be prepared for that. You're expecting to get 8, 9, 10%, but in any one year, you don't know what you're going to get. And you know that it's not always going to be positive. History tells us that. And so we prepare ourselves for those down years. And we'll learn that we can turn those down years into our advantage. Later. Slide 44. Again, I want you to ignore small company stocks. But what this is trying to show you is that the greater the standard deviation, the wider the distribution of returns. And the problem with these graphs is that they're all the same size. When you get down here into intermediate bonds and treasury bonds, these numbers look exactly the same as the numbers up in the large company and small company stocks. But really, they're much higher. There are many more years where you are closer to the average annual return when the standard deviation becomes smaller. And this graph doesn't really show that. So I'm not that keen on this graph. But the idea is it's trying to show you the greater the standard deviation, the wider the distribution of returns, and the riskier the investment as measured by standard deviation, which we already said is an imperfect measure at best. Slide 45, yet another view of risk versus return. And if this makes any sense, fine, and if not, just ignore it, because I'm not going to ask you about it. But you see, as the return goes up, the y-axis, the standard deviation is getting larger. So the return for T-bills is 3.7%, and the annual standard deviation is what? 3%, a little over 3%. T-bonds, the return doesn't get a whole lot more, but the standard deviation does. And then for stocks, wow, the standard deviation skyrockets, and so does the annual return. And again, ignore small company stocks. Slide 46. Aha! You didn't think I was going to let Sweden get the best of us, did you? Now, we're on slide 46. We can complete the global picture regarding risk versus return. Who had the best risk adjusted return? Well, if you go down the list of standard deviations, you'll find that, yeah, sure, Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, Switzerland had much higher return, but they also had much higher standard deviation. In fact, looking down the list, some of them had huge standard deviations and not very good returns. What a bad deal that is. Who had the best risk-adjusted return? Okay. Yeah, there's a reason why we are so awesome, folks. Why investors all around the world love to pour money into the United States. They know that they're not going to get the absolute best return in terms of dollars and percentages, but they also know they're going to accept less risk from their investments as measured by the standard deviation, which we said was already not a very good measure. But still, we're awesome, and we forget this. We just take it for granted. Slide 47. So, does yous got it yet? Does yous want high returns? Well, yous gonna get high risk. Yous gonna lose some money. Maybe all of your money. And if anybody tells yous differently, they're lying. And revert back to my Philadelphia accent. Right, folks, there's no way around it. It doesn't matter who or what they're hawking. If they're telling you that you're going to get a high return, you're going to get a high risk. And what happens is if you are involved in investing for any length of time, putting your name down on certain mailing lists or prizes or subscribe to certain publications, you're going to get on these lists. And you're going to get in the mail or on your email these eye-popping returns that just, you know, it's too good to be true. So when, not if, you see an advertisement for a 12% or 17% safe rate of return, you will know that the chances of losing your money are pretty darn high. And when you see such claims as 300% or 3,000%, and you don't believe me, but you're going to see these things. You're going to see these people jumping up and down, screaming and hollering, and all you have to do is sign up for their 3-day seminar for $2,995. Sit on your hands, grab your wallets, because they're also breaking the law. They're not allowed to say these things. I know it. What about free speech? Well, it's a regulated industry, and it's a long story. It's a long story, and we'll talk about it some other day. But there are countless examples of these people who some of them just outright break the laws. Others have, you know, skirted the laws. And one of the worst offenders was this guy named Wade Cook. They finally put him out of business, supposedly, but for decades, he was telling people that if they don't get 3,000% of their money, they're obviously not very smart. They need to take a seminar, and he's a scam artist. He got away with it. Just type in Wade Cook in any search engine, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Slide 48. But isn't somebody doing it, folks? Isn't somebody making tremendous rates of return? Sure, it is true that some people do this. But these people are not investors. They are traders. T-R-A-D-E-R. They are speculators. And, you know, if you want to do that, fine. You're going to need to do more than just take this class, because I certainly can't help you be a speculator. I can explain how it's done and how you can lose a lot of money. And I can warn you. But I can't do it, and I'm not even going to try. And you'll want to look up this guy, Jesse Livermore, because he was one of the first famous speculators and traders. And he went about it in a very cool, calm, collected, because that's what you have to do, manner, and he wrote about his experiences. The speculator is not an investor. His object is not to secure a steady return on his money at a good rate of interest, but to profit by either a rise or a fall in the price of whatever he may be speculating in. Now, I apologize for the male point of view, but he wrote this, you know, 70 years ago. And see, he understands what he's doing. He's saying, look, I'm not an investor. I'm not trying to create a long-term stream of income and capital gains. I'm in it for the short term. And it's not easy. Being a trader can be very profitable, but it is also very stressful and incredibly perilous. And you're up against the best in the world, folks. I mean, think about it. Have you ever tried to hit a fastball at 60, 70, 80 miles an hour? And then realize that the best people are hitting a fastball at 100 miles an hour. And you're going to go up against them? I don't always know that sports analogies are the best analogies, but they seem to work. Because when you get into this world, unlike the world of investments, where you really don't have to be that smart, folks, you don't have to be that good. You can just profit from the fact that the world is growing economically, and we all want people to have food, clothing, and shelter, and internet access. And so, but when you enter this world, oh my lord, you're going up against people that you just can't even imagine. So, do you want to be an investor or a speculator? Well, we can help you learn how to become a patient, prudent, successful long-term investment. We cannot help you learn how to become a successful short-term speculator. Sorry about that. The very best I can do is just show you what you're up against. And one of the best stories that has become a bit of a legend on Wall Street is between John Goodfreund and John Merriweather. And now in the face-to-face class, I would stop and read from this story called Liar's Poker. It's a famous book written by an awesome writer, Michael Lewis, and you want to read some of his stuff. He wrote recently a very good book called Flash Boys that has gotten a lot of press, and it's an excellent book. So I have that on the website. You can listen to me give you this story, or just go look it up, because it's an awesome story. And then you realize that you're up against people like John Merriweather and John Goodfroy, and you know what? Maybe you don't really want to be a speculator, don't really want to be a trader. Maybe you're just happy with an investor. I hope so. Worked for me so well, so far. Slide 49. So what is a realistic rate of return for me? Well, after you have taken this course, you will have a strong knowledge of the most popular types of, I should add, financial investments, securities, stocks, bonds, cash, mutual funds. We'll discuss real estate a little bit at the end of the semester. You will also know what levels of returns and what levels of risk you should reasonably expect to receive. And if you are a patient, long-term investor, I believe it is realistic to expect 8 to 10%. I'm certainly working on it myself, and I'm very optimistic about the prospects for the global economy over the next 20, 30 years, providing we don't blow ourselves up. Of course, as we will reiterate time and time again, there are no guarantees. Once you leave the world of short-term investments, you no longer are guaranteed. But you should be rewarded well for that. Slide 50. Okay, Payano, 8, 9, 10%. Is that good enough? Well, it turns out the answer to this question is yes. If you start early, which means, you know, 20s, 30s, even into your early 40s, after that it gets a little harder. You don't have a lot of time. If you are patient and consistent, if you do not get too cocky or greedy, and if you do not chase after every next big thing that comes along, and most importantly, you don't panic when the market swoons. Because it's going to. We know it's going to. It invariably will swoon from time to time. And if you panic and run, you've just set yourself back years. The trick is to take advantage of the time value of money, compound annual return. And on the website, now I'm not going to ask you to do it on the exam. This is something we do in Business 121, Financial Planning and Money Management. We learn about the time value of money and the future value. We're going to do present value because that's important to us as investors. But we already know from just looking at what some of these investments have done for people in the past that we're on the right track. Slide 51, the time value of money. The amount to which a sum you invest now will increase based on a specified rate of return and time period. Calculating amounts into the future is called compounding. Compounding our money, the future value of money. We can compute it for a single amount, a lump sum principal, a single payment. They all mean the same thing. Or we can compute it for a series of deposits, a stream of investments, multiple payments, or the term is called annuity, but I don't really like that because you can get that confused with the product that is sold by insurance companies. We are going to learn how to do the opposite. We're going to learn how to go from the future back to the present, and that's called discounting, the present value of money. And that's very important for us as investors. But later on, folks, much later on, the worksheet that's on the website is essentially the same worksheet that we use in 121. So if you've taken 121, it should look very familiar to you. It has the same bad jokes in it. And it shows that if we start early and are consistent and get 8, 9, 10, 11%, we're going to do well. We're going to do well. And it's good news. It's good news. Unless the world ends and then it doesn't matter. So go ahead and do that on your own. Or just look at the, you can listen to the commentary or just look at the answer key. Those problems will not be on the exam. I repeat, you do not have to do them. They will not be on the exam. Slide 52. This is where we would in the face-to-face class kind of take a look at them, you know, and run through them. We don't really have enough time to go through them in the face-to-face class, so we just sort of brush over them. But you can do the same. Just take a look at the answer keys if you're so inclined. Slide 53. One last comment on risk versus return. You want to avoid large losses. So, here's one of Pagliano's secrets. There's nothing secret about it, folks. I mean, this is why people are so afraid of the stock market, right? Until they kind of look at it and they go, oh, well, maybe it's not so bad. You know, look, take a look at this. One investment does, in year one, 85%, and the other one does 10%, which I'm very happy with, 10%, folks. And then the next year, because that first investment is so volatile, it loses 50%, and the other one goes up 9%. And you say, well, wait a minute, you know, still, you're ahead, right? If you go with the one that's more exciting and sexy and scary, and it doesn't turn out that way. No, folks, the numbers going down are a lot worse than the numbers going up. After the first year, our $100 becomes $185 for the sexy one, and the boring investment does $110. But now when we go down 50%, ouch, yeah, right, yeah. So that's why, you know, people are so worried about crashes, or so worried about really big losses. And so we'll learn how to deal with these. We'll learn how to live through them. And the trick is to just, you know, be consistent. And don't panic. And don't try to be a speculator. Buy things that, you know, they're going to get hit, but they're going to come back, because these are companies and investments that have their roots deep in the economy. And we'll discuss this in detail, folks. So don't, if you feel as you're missing something about what I'm saying, don't worry. We'll come back to it. We always come back to this. Okay, now, before we embark on the process of identifying and familiarizing ourselves with the longer-term, higher-yielding investments, let us learn how and where to park our money using short-term investments, okay? And that's the subject of our last presentation for Chapter 1. But wait a minute, one more time. The greater the variance and standard deviation of the average annual returns of an investment, the greater the risk. Another way of saying that is more volatile. The lesser the risk, the less volatile. There is no correlation, no relationship, or standard what? I always hated statistics. The greater the standard deviation, the variance, the greater the risk. Don't you dare get this one wrong on the exam, because it is bad for my self-esteem. So go back over and listen to this again, because it bears repeating. Risk versus reward. Risk versus return. Do you want to eat well, or do you want to sleep well? As we said, in our next presentation, we'll discuss short-term investments, get them out of the way, and then we'll start talking about the longer-term, more profitable places to put our money. Thank you very much for your excellent effort and attention. You get the feeling I really enjoy this. I do. I'm the luckiest guy in the world that I get to do this. See you in our next presentation.